The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for being here. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Currently Hillary Clinton's chief of staff, Huma Abedin began as an intern for the former First Lady in 1996. In the interim, she has served in the U.S. Senate as senior advisor to Senator Clinton, worked as a traveling chief of staff for Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign, was the deputy chief of staff in the U.S. Department of State, and was vice chair of Hillary for America in 2016. In her candid new memoir, she emerges from the wings of American political history to take command of her own story. Tonight, she'll be joined in conversation with award-winning journalist Tracy Matysak. Thank you both so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. Good evening, everyone. And thank you so much for being with us on this Friday night. We have lots of ground to cover, but do remember what Laura said, that if you've got questions, you can just click on that little question icon, put them there, and we'll get through as many as we can before we wrap for the evening. But all of that said, Huma Abedin, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Tracy, I am so happy to be with you tonight, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, before we get into the conversation, I think we would be remiss if I did not mention the fact that while you were born in Michigan, your parents started their American journey right here in Philadelphia.
That's exactly right. When I first heard that I was going to be able to speak to the Free Library of Philadelphia, I was jumping up and down because it is a very special city in my family. As I write in the book, my parents were both immigrants. My father came from India, my mother from Pakistan. They were both Fulbright scholars at the University of Pennsylvania. And it almost didn't happen because my mother was picking between the University of Pennsylvania and Berkeley. And she almost picked Berkeley, but she picked Penn. And from my earliest memories, my parents would bring us back to Philadelphia. They would tell us about their house on Chestnut Street. And in fact, in the book, the picture of my parents that I share is them standing in front of their house. And they had this pizzeria they always went to called Pagano's Pizzeria. I don't know if it's still there, but they loved it. So I'm so happy to be talking to you tonight.
Well, we are delighted to have you with us. Want to get into the book now. You often mention in the book that your preferred place is in the background, behind the scenes. And so it begs the question, what made you decide to write this book and to put your story out there?
Well, you're 100% right, Tracy. I have always preferred to be behind the scenes. I've liked to be the invisible person behind the primary person, whether that's my parents, my boss, or the man I was married to. And I was comfortable there. I mean, for me, it was always about the cause, the mission, the work I was doing. I didn't really care about being the center of attention. I write in the book how even on my wedding day, I felt uncomfortable being the center of attention. Even though I was the bride, it was a very strange place for me to be. But I did feel as though I have spent 25 years in public service, and some of it, much of it rather, in the public eye, and that other people were telling my story and sharing things about me. And finally, I decided to take control of my own story, tell my truth, because if I don't, somebody else is writing my history. And so I did.
So in telling your story, it also meant resurrecting Anthony's story and all of the pain that came with that. And tell me how you worked through that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I appreciate that somebody has actually framed it as the notion that Anthony has a story too and had a story, and he does. And there are things in the book that I don't share, or I'll say this is Anthony's story to tell. And I do try to tell it from the perspective of how it impacted me as the partner in the relationship. And so I sort of take the readers down that memory lane, meeting him, sort of being captivated by this really dynamic, smart, hardworking public servant, and then to go through a dream marriage that turned very sadly, very quickly into a nightmare, and then sort of the ups and downs that we went through as we tried to navigate bringing a child into this world. I was not even 12 weeks pregnant the first time Anthony's first scandal broke. And then trying to figure out how to navigate society, how to navigate our mental health, how to find help when we didn't really know who to turn to or, you know, how to make it work. And it took us a long time to get to that place. And it took me to a pretty dark place before I got to the other side in order to write this book, share my story. And then one of the reasons I did it was I think there are plenty of people in the world who've unfortunately had to endure or are enduring what I did. I just had to do it on the front page of the paper, and they haven't, and maybe I can help them in some way.
You said that writing the book was actually therapeutic for you.
It was, tremendously. You know, the reason I started early in my early life, my father, who I was very close to, I think my father always believed I would be a writer. And I tell a story in the book that when I was 10 years old, my father came back from a trip to London, and he brought me a book called Silas Marner by George Eliot. And it was, you know, I was 10 years old. I didn't really understand the material. But when I read the introduction, I realized that George Eliot was Marian Evans. And I went to my father and I said, why did she write with a man's name? And he said, in the Victorian era, women were not taken seriously as writers. So she used a man's name. But don't worry, when you write your book, you will use your own name and everyone will take it seriously. And so part of it, I think, is a little bit sort of honoring that, you know, that belief that my parents had in me.
Yeah. As Laura mentioned, you worked for Hillary Clinton and still do, but you've been there for 25 years, going all the way back to the time when she was first lady and you were an intern in the White House. And then you were a key aide for her during her time as a senator and during her first run at the presidency, and then as Secretary of State under President Obama, and then during her 2016 campaign. Huma, you have had a front row seat to history that most of us could only dream of.
You know, and I write, it's why I write in throughout the book, the gratitude, the sort of, and in part because I have had the privilege to serve, you know, in the Clinton administration, in the Obama administration, working with senators like John McCain, having an approach to the way I wrote the book, not sort of telling the story, but showing what it was like to be in those rooms, on those airplanes, traveling to those countries, being on the inside and seeing, I mean, really patriots doing the best they could to, you know, advance the causes that they thought were important for a nation. It's, I just, sometimes I do have pinch me moments. Like, you can't believe these stories. And that's why the book is so long and I put so many of them in there.
Yeah. You entered the White House right around the time that the Monica Lewinsky story was breaking, and Hillary Clinton herself was going through a very difficult marital crisis that was playing out in public. And of course, at that time, you could never have known that some years down the road, you would have your own marital difficulties playing out on the front pages of the paper. And I wonder, going back to that time when you first entered, or for when you were dealing with your own story, how did HRC, as you refer to her in the book, how did she counsel you during those difficult times?
You know, as you said, I was a 21-year-old intern when I walked into the White House in 1996, completely in awe of the experience, falling in love with the work, with the people. I talk about the culture of Hillary Land and the club and the support. You know, I think everyone goes through their own challenges and you can't compare situations. Back then, for me, my job was really to take care of her. I mean, I kind of experienced as that story broke, I chose to write a chapter about the impeachment in part because you can mark all of my professional advancements alongside kind of major news in that situation. And so I thought it was relevant to write it and I wrote it. But my job at the time, the way I handled it was I wanted to figure out how to make her life easier. She was dealing with so much stress and so much pressure. And so for me, it was that caretaking. In my situation, all those many years later, she's always approached our conversations as a friend first and as a boss next. And the advice she always gave me was, I'm here to support you. No matter what you choose to do, I'm here to support you. Just know you have that. And so I did carry that confidence in our relationship throughout all these years.
Yeah. Homa, you stood by Anthony's side for a long time, longer than some people in your orbit felt that maybe you should have. And after sort of the repeated sexting scandals and all of that that came with that, I mean, these were front page stories for a while. Why did you make the decision to stay as long as you did, and even to go so far as to publicly defend him when he was running for mayor back in, I think it was 2013?
Right. You know, I think a lot of people look at my relationship with Anthony from a 2021 perspective, and hindsight is 2020. And it is why I wrote in detail there. You know, when I was writing the book, somebody was helping with the research, told me that the most common headline about me during that period of time was, what is she thinking and what is wrong with her? And so I put in the book what I was thinking and why I made the choices that I made. But when it first, you know, when we were in it, I was trying to make the next right decision for myself and really for my child. When the first story broke, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I wasn't even 12 weeks pregnant. I was newlywed. We weren't just living a life. We were living this extraordinary life. I opened the chapter with a scene from Buckingham Palace, waking up, going to a white tie dinner, knowing I was carrying, you know, his baby. I was deeply in love with my husband. He's, you know, I thought I had the perfect husband. And then in the years following, as obviously his behavior changed and actually, you know, got worse, I don't believe for a long time, Tracy, that I understood it. I grew up in a family that, you know, my parents were very happily married. I didn't know anybody who was divorced. I didn't know how to handle it. I had anger and I had rage. But I couldn't figure out the why. I didn't understand. I don't think therapy did very much for me, even though I was in therapy. It took a long time for it to help. And that's why I share in the book all the things that Anthony did do. On the one hand, he took care of everything. He took care of our household and our schedule and our child and the caretaking. And then on the other hand, you know, he was living this life that was just shocking. And so It was a struggle. And the 2013, the reason I stood at that press conference, as I share in the book, is because I was trying to figure out, the first time it happened, I said, I just want my life back. And for me to get Anthony back into, I was trying to fix things and get Anthony back into a profession that I thought he was good at. It was a mistake in hindsight, but because I had encouraged him to run, I thought I needed to deal with the consequences and stand with him when that mayor's race fell apart.
You write very honestly about that time and in the immediate aftermath of standing up for him, that there were those in Hillary Clinton's orbit who felt like you had now become a liability, so much so that you feared losing your job behind it. How did all of that play out?
Well, I was told I was going to lose my job over it. It was horrible. It was, you know, this, you know, even at the time, people said, oh, you're making this big mistake. I even today, I don't believe I made a mistake in standing at that press conference, because as I said, to me, I felt like I was taking responsibility for a decision that we had made jointly. I think if I had understood clearly then the mental health challenge that he was having, the, you know, this falling into this behavior on these social media portals that had not been available to him before, and then all of a sudden were available to him, was something you just couldn't stop. You know, I write in the book, why, I don't understand, why can't you just knock it off? When you are in any kind of relationship with somebody who either has addictive behavior or, you know, can't stop, it's hard, you know, it's hard to navigate that space. And so I do write the scene. I was told Hillary was gonna let me go, and I drive to her house and she did not let me go, because as she told me, she valued the work I did professionally for her, and she did not believe it I should pay for my husband's mistake.
There was also a point where you thought you might lose your son, because everything that was happening with Anthony then kind of got you this unwelcome attention from the Child Welfare Services office in New York. And it just seemed to add a whole other dimension to all the crises that you were facing at that time.
It did. It did. It was a real. It was 6 months of both a terror, but also a defiance. I mean, I felt judged. I mean, it's sort of, and I write in the book, it's that because I was a working mother, and to say that because you were not present, questioning, you know, my capacity to care for my child, I took that very seriously and obviously was very relieved when that situation was resolved. It was extreme trauma.
And on top of all of that, Huma, there was the decision by then FBI Director James Comey to reopen the investigation into Hillary's emails. And of course, the reason that additional emails were found was because they were investigating Anthony and they find these emails on his laptop. As you write, and as we remember, it amounted to nothing. The investigation was quickly closed. But you write in the book about how you spoke with Anthony over the phone and you said that if Hillary loses the election, I'm quoting here, it will be because of you and me. And you say that you went on to write the following in your notebook. You wrote, I do not know how I'm going to survive this. Help me, God. And then, of course, she does go on, in fact, to lose the election. I mean, that is a heavy load to carry. How did you process all that?
Well, first, you know, God, faith, you know, one of the many reasons I wrote this book was to share what it is to be a Muslim, an American Muslim. And my faith has always been central and core to my life. And I do think God has carried me through in many ways. That conversation was a moment in time. I mean, in that moment, not knowing what was going to happen, because this announcement was so unprecedented. It was so shocking. And particularly when I had cooperated, it's why I write in the book that I had cooperated with the investigation from day one, that when I read in the paper there was an investigation and that I had been asked to provide material, I went down the hall to my office to call a lawyer friend of mine to say, no one's asked me to provide anything. How can I assist and send information? And so to a year later, to read in the news something that if I had been asked, I would have said, please take a look at it, you know, Tracy, I think I write this in the book too, which is I couldn't even feel anymore because feeling felt selfish in that moment. Like it was all about the mission. And the mission was the election in 11 days. And obviously we know how that ended, but that is something I do have to carry for the rest of my life. And it took me to a very dark place after the election. And I really had to get professional help to get to where I am sitting in this chair talking to you today. And I'm glad I got the help. I needed it.
You write of James Comey that he was a daily nightmare. And you said, even now, the memory of his decisions feels like torture. You said it felt like he was playing God.
You know, that was a decision, that was a choice that was made that affected the outcome of the election, in my opinion, period, full stop, it did. And I don't believe that it was necessary for them to have made that announcement. And they did. But I had to let go. You know, what I carried after the election was the feeling that she had single-handedly lost because of me. And that is the burden that I thought was, you know, too much to bear. And I did work my way through that. And I say it still creeps up on me. And, you know, actually no one has asked me this. But the still creeping up on me is when there are moments in this world, things that happen in our country that I don't believe would have happened if Hillary Clinton were president. That's when it creeps up on me. I don't think we would have lost as many lives to COVID if Hillary Clinton had been president. I don't think we would have put this deadline as related to pulling out of Afghanistan if Hillary Clinton was president. And that's when it creeps up on me.
Yeah. Fast forward to 2019, and there was a time that you describe as one of the most difficult periods in your life, as if 2016 wasn't difficult enough. And you write about how you couldn't eat, how you couldn't sleep, and how for a fleeting moment, you considered stepping off the subway platform. Take us back to that time. It was a very dark time for you, but it was also a major turning point for you. What happened there?
You know, I really chose to share this, you know, part of my story, and it was a very difficult time because I think this notion of community and support and knowing that you have support for me was so important. And for most of my life, you know, I talk about my early life, what we call in the Muslim world, the ummah, the community. And you always have a sense of support that if you need something, somebody's there. If there's a wedding, you go. If there's a funeral, you go. And I land in America at 17 to go to university. And then I joined Hillary Land, which really was a community. I mean, I write in that chapter, Hillary Land is how are you feeling? And let's, you know, let's help you fix this. And how is your mother? And go see my allergist. And Hillary Land is all these things, because Hillary Clinton is all these things. She really cultivated a culture of support. Even in 2016, going through all that stuff, I was surrounded by a tight-knit group of people. And 2019 was very different. I felt alone. Anthony was away. I had a brief period of period that he was away. I was a single parent. And boy, do I believe single parents are heroes, sheroes, and theyros. It was hard to be a single parent, juggling work and motherhood, and feeling very alone, not going into a big office every day. And I got so low. And just the fact that I thought about it for a fleeting moment told me in that instant, I need help. And I had to do it. And Anthony and I had to do it together. And it was brutal. We went through a process that's called a disclosure process. And for me, it was the only way through. It is the only way I was able to get to the other side and feel as healthy and whole as I do today.
Yeah. And when you talk about Anthony being away, of course, you're right that he was incarcerated for a period of time. He was ultimately diagnosed with sex addiction. And that was something that a friend of yours had mentioned to you some years prior, but none of the therapists that you were working with were using that term. And I know that, you know, Anthony has his own story to tell, but I'm just wondering, what do you want people to know about that, about sex addiction and what that is?
Well, you know, from my perspective, and I never really, you know, we were seeing therapists fairly regularly. I think the biggest thing I learned in that period in 2019, where I really embraced the process, because I had to let go of this notion. As somebody who's had so much control in her life, you know, I'm very good at organizing and control. And to me, I had to accept that there are some things that you can't control. And for some people, as I learned in therapy, that people, when they're in the midst of addictive behavior, they do things and they consider things that they never would when they're sort of in a much more present state. And so I had to be open to that. It's not that I thought we even necessarily had bad therapists, because we didn't. I had to be open to it. I had to understand it. You know, you go into therapy and it's not just 1 week or 1 month. It's a long process. And for him, he is still committed to the process. You have to remain committed to the process. So for me, it's less about whatever they've diagnosed him with. And it's about, how is he a good father for our child? How do I keep him in a place where he's a good partner and he's a good parent? Because I know that's the most important thing to both of us. And, you know, thankfully we've managed to do it. But as to his mental health and his addiction, I really prefer for him, you know, to talk about that.
Yeah. When you mentioned your child, you're talking, of course, about your son, Jordan, who is now 9, I believe. How is he handling all this, especially with the book coming out, you know, sort of the reminders of that time in your life? How's he handling all this?
Well, you know, on the one hand, he's like a typical 9-year-old where it's all about him. Like, he walked in here as I was setting up and saying, what's going on? Are you doing a TikTok video? And what's for dinner? And then sort of wanders off. And in some ways, I think it was a bit of a benefit that from the moment he sort of was conscious in the world, he had seen his parents sort of public. He was used to photographers being around. So he, in fact, I write a story in the book how early on, when he was like 3, if I remember correctly, he stopped one day at dinner and he says, "Mommy, why do strangers talk to you and Daddy on the street? You know, is it?" And we didn't really know what to say in the moment. And he says, "Is it because you work for them?" And we both said yes immediately. So he knows that his parents are public. I think he does have some memories of photographers chasing us down the street. So actually, when I told him Mommy had a book coming out, the first thing he said, "Does that mean those people are going to come back?" Mm-hmm. So I know he does have some memory of it. But I hope, you know, look, our intention is to be sources of truth for our child. And I hope when he reads this book, when he's old enough, that he's going to look back and he'll be proud of his mommy.
I want to talk about some of the other themes that come up in your book. And one of them, in writing about Hillary Clinton's political career, is the ongoing struggle that women leaders have, being judged by how they look, and how they modulate their voice, and not so much by what they do and how they think. And you write at some length about how you witnessed that firsthand in your time working with Hillary Clinton.
It's why I chose to write about all the different periods and how sexism did play a role in, frankly, every one of her campaigns. And my first experience with it was watching her in a debate in her Senate campaign against then Congressman Rick Lazio, where they're at a debate and he marches over to her with a piece of paper demanding that she sign it. And it was the first time you saw kind of this sort of in your face. And in that moment, we actually thought it was bad. We thought it showed weakness. We thought it showed that he was strong. And we're back in this, you know, hold room thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen? And it turned out to actually be to her benefit. But this constant in 2008, every time somebody made a comment about her clothes or how she spoke, or I don't like your jacket or your hair is so big, we laughed. I feel like as a society in 2008, we sort of giggled it off. We're like, oh, of course. It was sort of accepted that this is the price you paid to be in the game. And that was including us. We were in the game and we played it. And obviously, you know, everyone knows how that election ended. I mean, it ended very well in the end. I mean, President Obama was obviously a phenomenal candidate from day one. I write a lot about what it was like interacting with him and his team and working for him. So it was incredible. But 2016, fast forward, it was unbelievable. I mean, it was everything. And in fact, the story that people constantly bring up that I write in the book is the media consultant who said, you know, she looks angry when she gives her speeches. So you should put a picture of her grandchild so that when she looks down at her speech, she's going to feel happy because it's something that makes her happy. And thus she will appear happy. And I learned in that campaign, you were never going to please everybody. It was impossible. And then now fast forward to 2020, it was hard. We had all these qualified women running for president, that until we have sort of a national reckoning that we to see women as leaders, but it is very hard for women to be executives in this country, and forget commander in chief. It's a hill to climb for sure.
Yeah. Another theme that emerges from the book, of course, is work-life balance, or the lack thereof, or the pursuit thereof. You worked around the clock for the better part of 25 years, all while raising your son, dealing with everything that was going on with Anthony. You know, there were people around you who maybe resented your success, who threatened your life on occasion. What would you say, Homa, to someone who is listening, who loves their job, loves their family, and is just struggling trying to keep it all together?
You know, when I was a little girl, my father would say, and it's, I opened one of the chapters with this, with his saying, he always said, a good life is a balanced life. Mm-hmm. I did not follow that advice. The chapter where I talk about making a choice, get this brand new job at the White House. I'm at a family wedding in New York. I get a call saying, do you want to go to Argentina? And that's my fork in the road. Do I stay at this wedding, be with my family, or do I get on a plane and leave for work? I chose the plane, and I chose the plane every single time. And in part, it is because I had a job that was all consuming. It was about somebody else's life. I had the benefit. I told myself when the Clintons left the White House, that the day I woke up and did not want to go to work is the day I would give notice. And that day was 25 years ago. So I had the extraordinary privilege of having an all-consuming job. But in hindsight, particularly after Jordan was born, I mean, I write the scenes of, I would get pulled, tugged, you know, was I being a good mother leaving him? But here I am going out to create a world that's better for him. So I am going to leave. It was really hard. So the advice I always give, and I do this to my younger colleagues, balance is good. Balance is important. I didn't learn it. I mean, Hillary is actually the one who said to me, you know, I write in 2017 that, you know, my son's father is about to go to jail and I'm on the road. And she says, no, focus on your child. And so I think balance is good.
Yeah. Another theme that you write about is the power of female friendships. And you mentioned Hillary Land just a few minutes ago. Talk a little bit about that, about what you saw and the power, what you learned about the power of female friendships.
You know, I feel as though going back to the point I was making, and we were talking about sort of being married to my job, which I was, I took my friends for granted for most of my 20s and maybe most of my 30s, that it was, they were going to be around when I needed them. I would land at 11 o'clock at night and say, let's go get dinner. It was always on my schedule because I was working all the time. And it's only now, sort of, you know, as an adult, I recognize that I rarely made them priorities. I was always the priority. And it was only when I started losing friends over choices I had made, specifically to stay in my marriage, and to defend my husband, I lost friends over that. I realized that friendship is precious and we need it. I think of all my girlfriends now, even now on the book tour, you know, my girlfriends come along for the ride. They go to Colbert with me just before I went out. She's grabbing me and saying, let me fix your, you know, your top. I mean, it's just nice to have somebody at 11 o'clock at night to text and say, I'm just feeling low, or let's go eat. And those are precious, precious relationships. And I'm lucky to have a bunch of Hillary Land, the woman who helped me with the book, my collaborator is a member of Hillary Land, that when I was struggling with writing, I called her up out of the blue and said, I need you. She didn't even know what she was saying yes to. And she said yes. And together we created a book that I'm really proud of.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to have your tribe.
You got to have your tribe.
On January 20th, of course, we all watched Kamala Harris being sworn in as our first South Asian female vice president. And I wonder for you, as a South Asian female yourself, what that moment was like for you.
I mean, epic. I have goosebumps going up and down my legs, even as you said those words. I mean, it was so incredible, awe-inspiring, affirming about the possibilities. I mean, just the power. When she walked out, I just couldn't, I could not sit still. And she just represents everything that is so right about the possibility of our future. And we're all really proud of her. All of us brown girls out there, we are really proud of our vice president.
You were asked earlier this week in one of your TV interviews if you would consider running for office yourself, and you didn't totally rule it out. So I'm curious what that might look like for you.
Oh, Tracy, I have to tell you, that was my virgin interview. It was my first time on live TV. I was so nervous. I was so cold. I was shaking. And so I confess, I approached my whole book tour with the, you know, it's now been cut, but my epilogue originally was included all the women and men who inspired me to write my story. And one of them is Shonda Rhimes. And when Shonda wrote her book, her whole approach that year was, this is my year of saying yes. I'm stealing that from Shonda. So here I am thinking I'm being brilliant on the Today Show saying, this is my year of saying yes. And then I actually don't even think I heard her. And then she said, well, does that mean run for office? I said, yes, but the answer is no. So I guess it's my year of saying yes, but there are some conditions where I'm not running for office. And I've tried to clean that up this week.
Well, here's last question before we go to our audience question. And that is that you write in the book that on the other side of all that you've been through, and you have been through a lot, that you find two things, resilience, number one, and hopefully bliss. And so not happiness per se, but bliss. So the question is, where are you on that journey to finding bliss?
I'm on my journey to finding bliss. I don't have it yet. I've certainly had a lot of entertainment. And as you're referring to the story in the book where I was in India and went to a fortune teller, and he said, you've had a lot of entertainment in your life, but there's a difference between entertainment and bliss. And I am on that path. And one of my colleagues actually told me this morning that he has never seen me so light and unburdened, unlifted, even though I am doing right now with you the thing that terrifies me the most, which is being out there. And so I think maybe I'm really on a good path to finding my bliss.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's go to some questions from our audience. Mayali asks, or says, first, I want to say that I'm so inspired by your strength. I do want to ask, what is your relationship with Anthony now? And is he seeking help?
My relationship with Anthony is good. And in that we are both committed to raising our child. It's work. He is regularly in therapy and regularly takes care of his mental health, which I think is very important. And he recognizes that, and he is doing the work. But we are both very present for our son. And I'm glad my son has two parents. I didn't have a choice when I lost my father.
Yeah. Speaking of your son, Joanne asks, what does your son currently understand about his father's past?
Well, we've chosen to share with him as age appropriate. And I, you know, he's, as we discussed, he's nine. And as he gets older, he'll have more access to information on the internet. And so we have already sought professional help in terms of how to talk to him about it. And we're feeling good about that structure of support we've put in place for him.
Yeah. Politics question here from David, who says, given the results of the election on Tuesday, what direction should the Democratic Party go at this point? Of course, referring no doubt to the results in Virginia, where Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, lost that race. Jersey, Phil Murphy won, and a mixed bag in between. So what do you think about the direction in which the Democratic Party should go?
Well, look, Joe Biden's administration is trying to do some very difficult things. And we've had these bills stuck in Congress that they're trying to move forward. And I understandably, people are frustrated at how long it's taking. But it's important work. And it's, you know, they're trying to do some big things, unprecedented things in some ways. And COVID has obviously not helped. But I do think I like to remind myself that the year after a president from one party is elected, it's not unusual for us to suffer in the next election. We just have to keep our enthusiasm, our energy. The other side was more motivated, obviously. But yeah, we have some work to do. We have some work to do. We have to keep people engaged. The administration has to show results. And they will. They are working on it. I think once we get a little bit more progress, we'll be having a slightly different conversation.
Yeah. Question about your background here. Tom asks, what did you study in college? And what led you to apply to be an intern at the White House? How did Hillary come to interview you for that position?
Tom, I never actually got an interview with Hillary. And this is one of the things that she now likes to deny. I was not a sure shot. I was like, I was okay. I wasn't amazing. But when I was a teenager, and I write about this in the book, my dream was to be Christiane Amanpour. And I had a friend who I met through the Black Student Union at GW, who was interning at the White House for Mike McCurry. And she said, I'm working in the press office. You should apply. She brought me the internship. I never thought I would get the internship at the White House, filled out the forms, went home to Saudi Arabia, came back, was placed in the First Lady's office, and it changed my life. You know, it wasn't my plan A, but plan B, boy, did it turn out to be pretty spectacular.
Dennis asks, how did you meet Anthony to begin with?
Anthony and I met on Martha's Vineyard in the summer of 2001, and Bill Clinton had just left the White House. And it was this, you know, balmy summer weekend, and a member of Hillary Land comes over and says, this charming man wants to meet you. And I was always working. I never, you know, kind of had, dabbled in these sort of flirtations with men when I was working. And this man comes over, and sure enough, it's this congressman who's Hillary's colleague. And it wasn't love at first sight. He sort of just made an impression because he was so, you know, he had such a big personality, and then we would see each other off and on. And we became friends first before it was anything else. But that was the first time I met him.
Laura asks, do you have any advice about healing from betrayal trauma?
Laura, the best advice I can give is only the advice that worked for me, which is you have to take the time to feel. I, for a long time, did not allow myself to feel anything but anger and bitterness. And I compartmentalized a lot of my feelings. And it was only when I allowed myself to feel and to forgive myself. And it took time, at least for me, it took time.
Ellen asks, how do you navigate raising a mixed race child in the Trump/post-Trump America?
We live in New York, which I think is a blessing in some ways. And that thankfully that has not been a challenge in terms of how we navigate it, but it is something we're going to have to think about, particularly after, some of the, as you said, the death threats and the you know, the hate mail that I've had to receive, it's not something I don't think about. I do think about it. And I just do the best I can to protect my son. It's one of the reasons why there are no pictures of him in my book.
Sheila asks, how hard was it to let go of the unfairness that you have endured and not be bitter?
I was bitter for a long time. And as you read the book, you will see it almost killed me. The only person it was hurting and affecting was me. I didn't think I was, you know, my best self or my best mother or the best mother I could be. But I had to let go. I had to let go and understand. I had to stop pain shopping. A friend said every time I was, you know, trying to figure out what was going on, it's pain shopping. I had to learn the truth, process it, and move on. It worked for me.
Yeah. Winifred asks, what are the books that you loved most growing up, and whom do you like to read? I know you talked about at least one of those books that your dad started you off with.
I love memoirs. I mean, I'm staring at a stack of memoirs that I want to get through. Don Lemon's and Billy Porter's, Katie Kirk's and Cal Penn's are all sitting right here. I love people's stories. I opened the book saying that I grew up surrounded by stories. When I was a little girl, I loved all the Jane Austen novels, and I pretty much read everything. I mean, I read The Brothers Karamazov. My father brought back a lot of novels written by African writers like Wole Soyinka. And I sort of just absorbed a little bit of everything. But I would probably say Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility. I kind of fell into those when I was a little girl.
Yeah. Robert asks, in writing your book, what was the hardest and the happiest memory that you had? And he also says, thanks for all you do and for inspiring many women.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that question. The happiest was when my little boy came out into this world. And that's why I write about that experience, like just becoming a mother. You can't explain it until it happens. And then you get it. So certainly that was the happiest. And the hardest, now you're going to get me emotional. You know, this book really is a love letter to my dad. I lost him when I was 17. He was terminally ill. You know, he was diagnosed with renal failure when I was 2, and he was told he had 5 years to live. And the only time I broke down when I did the audio for my book was when I was talking about my dad. Really, this book is for him. And I want to share this book with him and say, this is what I did, and I hope you're proud of me. So it's hard. Everything related to my father, especially losing him, that was probably the hardest, personally, the hardest part.
And Robert's follow-up to that is, will we be seeing a kid's book by Huma in the future?
Robert, if you think this is a good idea, I am going, maybe somebody from my publishing house is watching. And You never know. This book was much longer. They cut it. I loved the process of writing. And so maybe that's part of my year of saying yes. It's such so much easier than answering the politics question. I love this suggestion.
And Robert also adds, thank you, Huma. Your dad is proud of you, he says. Let's see. Oh, my goodness. So many questions from our audience here. Let's see.
Great. This audience asks excellent questions.
Tom wants to know, would you ever work for another female presidential candidate if you were asked?
Tom, I have been there. I have done that. And so I know what it takes. I don't know that I could. I will say this, though. If a female presidential candidate asked me to help her, the answer would be yes.
Let's see. Sadaf asks, will Huma be coming to the San Francisco Bay Area for a book signing?
Sadaf, listen, I am doing a virtual event, a San Francisco virtual event with Cal Penn on Tuesday, but they aren't doing a lot of in-person events there. So unfortunately, I won't be there. But if I do show up, maybe Laura can help connect me to you, and maybe I could sign your book.
Let's see what else we have here. Mayali asks, how did you like being on The View? And also, I'm sad that the Philly book tour was not in person.
I am sad too. I would have much rather been next to Tracy talking to all of you in person safely. But I'm thrilled there's a book event at all. So let me show my gratitude for that. Wait, what was the first part of the question?
About being on The View.
Oh, I loved The View. I couldn't tell. It didn't even feel like being on camera. I just felt like a chit chat. Those women were incredible. I enjoyed the conversation. It felt like having coffee with girlfriends.
Yeah. Question from Winifred, who says, thanks for your candor and for your service. Would you walk us through your day at work? I'd love to know what you can tell us, a day in the life.
Well, my days start very early, but these days, it depends on which section of my life you're asking about, but they start pretty early. I think I've changed my priorities to make sure that my schedule works so I can drop my son off to school every day. That has not been the case this week, unfortunately, with all these book events. And it's usually in a pre-COVID time, I'm just running from meeting to meeting. I usually don't eat lunch, or I'm off on a plane somewhere. COVID has changed my work schedule rather dramatically. I spent a lot of time on Zooms. But who knows, after this book tour and hopefully the world is back open again, I'll have a different answer for you.
Mike asks, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
I think the best piece of advice I've ever been given, I have to go back to my parents, this notion of a good life being a balanced life, finding the possibilities and everything, doing a little bit of everything, not getting sort of tunnel vision about things, which I tended to do. And I'm trying to live intentionally by that advice now. I didn't before.
Yeah. Well, before we say goodbye, just a couple of comments here. Someone says, OMG, you were amazing on The View. And many thank yous for your service. And there's one that I wanted to make sure that I read, and it says, we need Huma to run for office. You have so much experience and the future is female. So there you have it.
I agree, the future is female. Agree. Thank you for all those comments. I'm really humbled. Thank you so much, honored. Thank you.
Well, Huma Abedin, it has been an absolute delight to have an opportunity to talk with you. Thank you so much for writing this book. I know that a lot of people have been inspired and encouraged by your honesty and your transparency in the book. And I'm sure, you know, as we've talked about, there are a lot of people who really have connected with you through it. So thank you so much for writing it, for making time to talk with us here at the Free Library tonight. What a delight.
Tracy, I have enjoyed this conversation so much. It went by so quickly. I loved all the questions, and I'm really thrilled to have been with you all tonight. Thank you for giving me part of your evening.
Well, before we say goodbye, I want to thank all the folks at the Free Library, Andy and Laura and Jason, the author events team, for bringing all of us together. We thank all of you for joining us tonight. We hope that you found the conversation to be insightful and encouraging. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.